Day 6 of the February 04 7-day retreat in Springwater. Day 6 of the February 04 7-day retreat in Springwater. The mind itself, meaning the brain and also the body, very sleepy, almost drowsy. I know there's a talk to be given, so there will be a talk. We have been sort of going back and forth over this whole thing of intention. It has not been settled for a lot of people. It doesn't seem right to say, I have no intention, or this work doesn't come out of intention. Intention. Of course there is, there comes a cut off point where I start saying, well, a talk has to be given. But this cut-off point doesn't just sit here today on a morning of a retreat. How far do I take that back? Certainly as far as talks have been given. And then, why did I get into this in the first place? Because I did not want to. I did not try to get the Roshi to give me whatever you call it, sanctioning. Also, he did that on his own. It wasn't my push for it. But here I was, and he asked me to give talks, and here I gave talks, even though I didn't want to, but I did, because he asked me to. And why do I do things? Because people ask me to. Some other people may have said, I recently asked somebody in a retreat in which I'm a participant and where people give talks, or we have these groups, and I said to one person, why don't you give a talk sometime? Because I really think there's a great profundity in this person, clarity. And he said, no, I'm not ready for this. There's much too much coming from my head. And so somebody else may have felt good, flattered, hoping he will be named and put in the newsletter or something. This person wasn't like that. So what I'm trying to say is, were you going to cut off and say, here is where my intention starts? It's very arbitrary. It didn't start this moment that I think it's starting. When I came to the Zen Center the first time, there was a small residential building, and the Roshi was giving evening at the end of each week. Every Friday for 6 weeks, he gave a teisho. And people could come and then could sit afterwards. And at that time, I was in a lot of search for something meaningful, to do something meaningful. There was this Alan Watts, I had read almost all of his books, and the Joyous Cosmology, and if he had been around and I knew him, maybe I would have taken LSD. I would have had the intention, but I didn't. How come other people did? So here were these talks, and I remember really being very aware how concentrated I was. I could look that Roshi in the face and I could tell he was looking at me too. He noticed that. And one time when I didn't go and Kyle went alone, he said, "Where's your wife? Why didn't she come?" or something. So, in other words, I didn't have to learn concentration and attention. It was already there. Not in the same way as today. It was very much driven by being noticed, by me making an impression. Not an impression so I would be asked to do this teaching. That wasn't the thing. Just to impress somebody with one's capacities. We all know that, don't we? Unless we have a different kind of enneagram or whatever you call that. Somebody told me about this in California. It was sort of intriguing, 9 different types of people, and that's how you are. Not that you intend to be this way, but these people say this is how you are. I forget them, what all these differences are, but you probably know better about it. So, it was not difficult to get through the koan, even though for some people it was very difficult. I wondered why, because I needed to get through this. I didn't want to sit with this koan mu for the rest of my life. It was, it felt like something in front of me, a board in front of my head. So I don't know how I got through, but I did, and worked on other koans. But the main thing to me was to have some quiet space to be attentive, to be aware. And the way the Roshi handled it at the time, if you'd gone through your first koan, he said, "Now you're going to get a new koan every time, and if you have solved it in your mind, then put it on the shelf, and you can either go back to mu, because mu is infinite in its possibilities, deepening of your mind, or you can just do shikantaza, which meant just sitting." And that's what appealed to me. I wasn't going to go back to mu. And so, was that an intention? Was that a choice made? Or was it just this was what was appealing and which also suited the way my mind operated? To watch itself, and it was probably no happenstance or how do you say it? Zufall.
Coincidence
that Kyle and I ran into Krishnamurti's teaching, which became very important after Roshi did ask me to take over the center after he moved someplace else, because I knew I couldn't teach in a Zen way. That was clear. Not an intention. I didn't want to teach in that way and in the format, which did not, I feel, suit me or suit a lot of other people. That there was a better, gentler, kinder way. And because Krishnamurti sort of denigrated or seemed to denigrate all meditation. He always had something negative to say about it. But what he probably meant was sort of a meditational repetitive practice. And often in front and on the tarpaulin, the first two rows were people in red and orange robes with these big malas on their chest. And he had them right in front of his face, and he was very tempted, and not just tempted, he made remarks about meditation and following the guru. Pretty mean, but these people, that didn't detract them, because their teacher had said, "Go to this man, he's good, he's wise, he can learn something." So I still remember sometimes during a break, between the morning talk and in the afternoon, there were tapes played which were in another little building, and people would sort of congregate around this building before it was opened. And what I see right now in my memory is a bunch of Indians, Far Eastern Indians, sitting together or talking together and not understanding what Kay was talking about. And I said, well, you will not understand it. You have to do meditation. And they, very interested, what kind of meditation? And I told them about the three pillars of Zen, and they wrote it down in their book, Philip Kaplow, Three Pillars of Zen, and they were going to go following that, because I said, if you do that kind of thing, you may understand easier what Krishnamurti is talking about. I was really proper, how do you say, propagandizing, which I wondered later, what was I doing, you know? I just had to do this because this was my state of being at the time. So very identified with Zen, sort of proselytizing, that's the word I was looking for, which has changed. I've dropped that thing pretty much entirely. So there is a development in somebody's life due to unoverseeable circumstances of the past and present, that sort of like in a mountain you have, particularly when the snow starts melting or after rain, you have thousands of little trickles and rivulets which eventually find a larger stream, and that larger stream finds a bigger stream, river, and then eventually finds the ocean. So this is, I think, how our life proceeds. It is a stream of 1,001 rivulet of influence and experience and what we go through. What is our inheritance? I had inherited sort of a scientific bent mind, at least this urge to put something clearly and to understand something clearly. This was the way my father's mind worked. And I was very fascinated and interested in the dialogues between David Bohm and Krishnamurti, because these were the only dialogues that really came to something. Everybody else was sort of smashed by Krishnamurti. Couldn't express themselves satisfactorily to him. But he listened to Bohm, even though he often also felt he didn't understand. But so I learned a lot from David Bohm and from those dialogues, and listened to all the tapes of his dialogue groups that he founded, because he felt after a while, having dialogued ad infinitum with Krishnamurti, and Krishnamurti not feeling that he had understood, and maybe he himself felt people didn't understand in that format which Krishnamurti was using, not intentionally, which evolved for him. So David felt that there could be a group consciousness evolving in a group, and maybe in that group dialogue something could come to fruition that doesn't come to fruition in a one-on-one. That was his conviction, and he put a lot of energy and love into these dialogues that he held in many places of the world. He particularly also went to Israel, hoping that maybe if these people were getting together, dialoguing with each other, and as he put it, suspending their prejudices and ideas, meaning hold them in suspense and look at them, that maybe we could get together collectively rather than fight each other. Well, if you look at the state of the Middle East right now, I don't know what effect any of this had. And he very vividly describes one dialogue that got very heated between an Arab and a Zionist, or I don't know whether the other person was an Arab, but there was almost insoluble argument heating up. But then he says, fortunately, there were some people there who were cool. They were not identified, and they were able to cool down this heated argument, even though I think one person left couldn't take it anymore. So this was where Bohm took... Oh, maybe this is why somebody thought I said Krishnamurti felt this was the way to come to understanding. It wasn't Krishnamurti, it was David Bohm, the theoretical physicist, who, to my way of reading him and listening to him and watching him in dialogue, had an immense understanding, because no one can talk and write like David did without seeing something, without having a well-developed capacity to see. But he did not practice meditation. That was an unknown quantity to him. And I remember once, after a Krishnamurti talk, Bohm often attended them there in Ojai. And he would sit under a tree afterwards or before. And people, young students and other people, would gather around him and ask him and try to understand what Krishnamurti was saying, hoping maybe David could explain it. And he would give his little talk there in this under the tree group. And one time, I wasn't sitting down, I was just standing there. And I said something, because there was the urge to say something. It seemed to be appropriate. And he said to me, don't jump ahead. We'll come to that later, to the self. It was something about the self. And I realized that he was also working with a structure. First you talk about this and then that, and in the very end you talk about the self. You don't bring that up any which place. Whereas I felt somebody had a really pregnant question right at this moment, and why not enter in on it? But that wasn't his style or intention, whatever you will call it. But this amazingly clear, concentrated mind. When one person who was very close to the Krishnamurti circle, he came to a retreat with us at the lake. He came with his brother, and the two of them, they were wrapped in blankets, sitting on the bench there near the freezing lake, and sat together and walked together. And one time, one of the brothers came into the doksan, and he said, now it's clear what it means, the observer is the observed. It's clear. That's what actually had come for to understand, because it was one of the essential sentences of Krishnamurti's teachings, is the observer is the observed. Meaning, do you understand it? What we say is there's only the heartbeat, or the ring in the ear, maybe a pain in the hip, or the sound of silence, but no one observing it. It's just this. And this became clear on a cold winter day to Tom, sitting with his brother on a bench, wrapped in a blanket. He had done meditation. He had come to the Zen Center for training period. But this soldier that I've talked to some people about too, and it's in one of the books, the Marine who came to see me some 30 years or so after the war, the Vietnamese War. Some experience had become very, very alive for him. He needed to talk to somebody because he said he's never found anybody who would understand that. And somehow he had heard about this place and called if he could talk to someone. And we met in the apartment and he told me about being there in Vietnam and being a helicopter marine. And the order was, the commando was to find a hill which was full of Viet Cong and to take that hill from the Viet Cong. And the commanding officer asked for volunteers. And there wasn't the one who volunteered for this mission. So names were just called up and his name was among them. And he told me his knees were so shaky when he climbed up the steps that he didn't think he'd make it up to the door of the helicopter from fright. And then as the copter set in motion, at one time he said something happened which he's never been able to understand, but suddenly all the fear was gone and there was just a pervasiveness of love. I don't remember all the words he used, but it was very clear what he was saying. And then he said, we didn't find that hill. We turned around. It wasn't there. What that had to do, I don't know. They turned around without having accomplished their mission. And then he was full of wanting to tell his brethren, his fellow Marines, and they were just laughing at him and thought he'd gone off his rocker. So now this guy, now I wonder how come he even found the Springwater Center, because he was very sort of a roughly hewn man. He was a steel plant worker. You could see his build and everything. You could see him in front of one of those furnaces and working with this hot iron. And when I've sometimes seen it on the news, I'm in awe over people doing that, being capable of standing that heat and molding things and hammering and in that hellish atmosphere of red-orange light. So he had never heard of meditation. And his intention certainly hadn't been to come to enlightenment, but he was pretty sure he was going to die. He didn't think that he was going to come alive out of this mission. So that may have some amazing impact upon a human being. This direct, immediate confrontation with death, which, if it's that immediate and direct, means, doesn't it, there's no way out. This is it. And is it then that the me drops off with all of its shenanigans? It is immobilized, it is incapacitated, can't know what to do anymore. And when that me husk or cocoon snaps open and drops off, well, then there's the butterfly, the beauty of this unfolding moment, with which I don't mean time motion. It is a timeless moment. And I'm not fighting people who insist that the meditation practice helped them. And when I started teaching or working, I never called it teaching for many reasons. When I started working this way, well, people would challenge me left and right and say, well, how can you say that because you went through a very rough training? How can you say that Well, I can't say it wasn't necessary, and I have never said that. I'm not aware that I did. But there are mysterious ways of the truth unfolding or opening up right in front of our eyes. Totally unintended, unintentional, unpremeditated. Here it is. And this was the feeling I brought to this work, is to have people sit down, because they came here to sit, they appreciated something about entering silence motionlessly, and just be with what is there. To get to know the 10,000 things that keep us entangled. The 10,000 things that make up this cocoon. To get familiar with that, to get to see it, to understand it, and not to be deluded by it. That is our true being, this cocoon existence. To sit down and want enlightenment, that is the most frustrating thing in the world, and people find it out for themselves. They want to get it, they work hard, and as one Zen master says, the faster you run after it, the faster it gets away from you. But that is given to us, to begin to meet up with what is hindering us. First and foremost, our preoccupation with ourselves, with our own significance or importance or unimportance. This me, me, me cocoon or web, sticky web in which we're caught. To begin to notice that and watch it and begin to understand that that is in the way. Not to reach for what is behind it. No, you can't jump over it, but let it come to light, to full understanding, in sitting quietly and not groping for something else, because everything is here. Not just the 10,000 delusions, but also that capacity to see them, to become aware of them. That's there. It's given to human beings. So. So it's a wonderfully interesting thing to watch, because we insist too early that we choose at the fork in the road, we choose which way to go. Meaning there is someone who makes a choice, me, I'm making that choice based on my preferences and whatever. But that is too vague an expression. It shows that one has not really deeply looked at this with a huge magnifying glass, which at the same time slows things down so it can be observed. I always use this example, because it happens so often these days of lying down and then knowing I have to get up, either for a meal or giving a talk or doing some shopping or doing some cleaning, or just the idea I can't be in bed all day long. It's a very driving idea. But an immense inertia and weight to stay in bed, even motionless, because there's a fear of moving, because then it may feel worse than it's feeling now. This whole bundle of weighings, should I do this and what are the consequences, and or should I do that and the consequences. And then often we stop attending and say, well, then I decided to get up because, in fact, the feet are hanging over the bed now, ready to go into the slippers. But I've tried to catch this decision to get up, and I haven't caught it. I haven't found it. I find these ponderings, the tendencies, and visualizing getting up or staying in bed, and all the preferences. But then there is getting up. And I don't find the thought, I've got to get up. That thought was underlying the whole time, but that was not the thing that prompted the getting up into the vertical position. There's a huge field that, if you will, makes that decision or brings that about. The huge field of consciousness / unconsciousness, I don't know, is not as simple as thought wants to make it in our description of it, as though there's a little being inside that decides, I'll do this now and not that. Thoughts there are galore about this and that. But how does it come to this or that? We have to go back to Adam and Eve, if that's your particular religion. Other early beings who decided to create the world. That's another fairy tale. The latest in physics is not a creation of the world, but very similar to the Far Eastern meditative systems, where there's constant evolving and devolving. Not one creator. To be made responsible for all of this. It's evolving. And if there is, you can call it intention or the desire, the longing to really follow this, see it for oneself, then you will, because this is given to us to observe without the observer. Now, this has been a totally different talk from what I had. I hadn't even intended. I didn't know what to talk about and thought, this will be the first time where I'll sit here and really have not much to say. But things happen in an amazing way. Yeah. Caw, caw, caw. Oh yeah, there was this sleepy, dreamy state. Which could say, put it in words, well, you're not fit to give a talk. You can't. You're too dreamy, sleepy. But I have learned not to trust those voices because they're not true. They don't tell the truth, what you can and can't do. Just let it flow. Without any intention. We will end here for today.